Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with art historian Allison Levy, whose new book is House of Secrets, The Many Lives of a Florentine Palazzo. Allison Levy is a New Orleans native, an art historian who is now digital scholarship editor at Brown University. Today we're talking about her new book, House of Secrets, The Many Lives of a Florentine Palazzo, a book about a house I think we'd all like to live in for a while. Allison, welcome to The Reading Life.
Hi, Susan. Thanks for having me.
It's such a pleasure to meet you. Now, this is a house, the Palazzo Rucellai, that has captivated you for a long time. When did you first encounter it, and why did it take such a hard hold on your heart?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, I first encountered Palazzo Rucellai in a classroom in New Orleans in the late 80s. I was an art history major at Newcomb, and I started off as a biology major, as I think many of us do sometimes. I was a little bit misguided, and I realized that pre-med was not the direction I was destined to take after my freshman year. And so I started just to explore other courses, and I took an art survey course. And the course was taught by a member of the faculty who specialized in the Italian Renaissance. So you can imagine where the emphasis was and the passion in his teaching. So I just fell for the Renaissance, and of course Florence is such an important part of that story. And I changed my major immediately. I was set. Art history was my future. I knew it. And so a year or two later, I took a seminar. I guess I was a senior at that point, a seminar on Alberti, who is the architect of Palazzo Rucellai. And so that's when I truly learned much more about the building, and I was just smitten. I don't know what it was especially. I think in a lot of ways it was the intensity of the course, you know, as an undergraduate to be studying one person from that time in such depth. I just felt that I just had a greater connection to Alberti and his architecture, and that was sort of the beginning for me. And then whenever I visited Florence, which was quite often because I then went on to graduate school to study art history, so I had lots of opportunities to spend summers in Florence, and I always, without fail, walked in front of Palazzo Rucellai whenever I could, even going out of my way to do so, and just admiring it. But that's something of a remove, because in graduate school and in my early career, I focused on portraiture, not architecture. But this remained very, very dear to my heart.
And then, on a sabbatical year, you had this remarkable opportunity to live there.
Yes. I was not expecting it. That's right. I was an assistant professor at the time, and I was in need of a break. I was a little bit burnt out, and so I knew that this year ahead, you know, had to be very important for me. I was going there to write another book altogether on tomb sculpture, something of a heavy topic. And I was searching for an apartment, looking online, and I wanted something special. Never in my wildest dreams imagining that I would find something in Palazzo Rucellai, but sure enough, there was this this advertisement for an apartment, and it read in, you know, as these apartment descriptions go, very small, cozy apartment. And the last line was, located in the famous Palazzo Rucellai. And I thought, that can't be. That's just great marketing. I called because I knew enough about the building beyond the classic art history narrative. I knew that the family still owned it and that it was still a private palazzo. So I called the agency and they said, in fact, yes, the family rents out a few rooms. And I said, well, I will take it. So that's how I got in the house.
That's all you needed. I mean, I'd like for you to read a little bit from the beginning of the book, talking about having the run of the house and what that felt like.
All right. So I'd been in the house just a couple of days now, still getting my bearings. All right. As I was the sole tenant, Nico, the porter, had let this slip on day two. I'd been enjoying myself immensely, having effectively the run of the house. Nico lived there too, but only Sunday evening through Friday evening, and he slept in an alcove just off the courtyard. Well past retirement age, the guard was safely tucked in every night by 8 p.m. That's when, as a morgue-like hush fell over the palace, I would roam the halls, knocking on blind archways, daring the ghost to wake. I took great delight in swishing down the marble staircase, bowing to battered portrait busts of adopted forefathers at every dusty landing. I even took the liberty of sorting through the family mail, which still passed through a slender slot carved to resemble a foreshortened Roman sarcophagus, or, as I always thought, a parted mouth. Though I knew that Florentines had long made a habit of recycling family names, standing there in the vestibule, fingering a certain Giovanni's correspondence, took my breath away. I also went behind the scenes and between the walls. I drew back curtains in quarters that were not mine to enter, enjoying views of the city that only Rucellai eyes, I like to imagine, had taken in. I discovered in a rear corner of the Piano Nobile, tucked not too far from a tiny rectangular chapel, a disquietingly narrow spiral service stair which ran, unilluminated, from the tip-top of Palazzo Rucellai to rock bottom. Adding to the sense of peril was the absence of a central solid axis. In lieu of a supporting pole, let alone a railing of any sort, was a brittle rope, knotted at regular intervals and suspended some 70 feet. With steady steps, I began the ascent, my left hand tightly grasping the knuckles of the fiber pendulum as my right hand trailed flatly along the enclosing wall. I didn't manage to complete a single revolution before I seized up with fear. If the Contessa found out. Rather than lose my footing in the dark, I returned to the front of the palace and jimmied my way into the ballroom. I entered easily enough, only to discover that the enormous square room with its white-on-white wedding cake styling was already occupied. Gambling overhead was a gaggle of gauze-draped maidens in various degrees of undress. I kept my head cocked back for a good 5 minutes, titillated by the risque fresco, its sensuality heightened by a sorbetto-tinged palette. Perfectly besotted with these Rococo beauties, I floated up to join them on top of the world. Enchanted, I remained. What was I looking for, breaking and entering my way through Palazzo Rucellai after hours? There was the novelty of the address, undeniably, that I now possessed a key to the front door of Alberti's magnum opus exhilarated me. But my stealth meanderings through the house weren't merely of an academic nature. There was also something achingly personal about my movements. The way I fingered the mail, for example, or the way I cupped doorknobs, even the way I sank into and petted the upholstered furniture. All of these gestures betrayed a dire and unapologetic covetousness on my part. For what I'd finally found in this house, I believed, was a home. I grew up not in a Greek Revival townhouse in the Lower Garden District, nor in a Creole cottage in Faubourg Marigny, but in a two-story, four-bedroom tract house on the west bank of the Mississippi River. My parents were stylish people who knew good architecture, but they were also new business owners. My venturesome father had given up his professorship in mathematics for a second career in the retail school supply industry when I was 7 years old. Hence their 1975 purchase of the 10-year-old suburban cookie cutter, a decision driven by cost and convenience. Admirable priorities these, sensible ones too, for we spent most of our waking hours at the store. 3 miles away, in the middle of a strip shopping center anchored by a kosher Cajun deli on one end and a fabric store on the other, our unconventional family life played out. Friends and relatives visited during business hours. My brothers raced hand trucks, with me on board, between Oldsmobiles in the parking lot. Scolding took place in the back room. We held our birthday parties at the store. I lost teeth at the store. When a hurricane threatened, we slept on preschool rest mats piled high on the mezzanine. And several times a week, no matter the weather, dinner came from the deli 5 doors down. Even our dog, either tethered behind the front counter or left to his own devices in the attached warehouse, called the store home.
Well, it's so interesting to me that you're enjoying this sabbatical year after Katrina, when I think all New Orleanians were thinking about architecture and thinking mm-hmm. about what home really meant.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It was the year, the last year of that teaching position when Katrina hit New Orleans. I was in Providence at the time. I was teaching at Wheaton College then. And there was a great sense, obviously, not just the sense of loss, the reality of loss, but also questions about place and spaces and memories that structures hold. And then when I was soon thereafter, the next year in Florence, sitting in archives, in old libraries, doing research on this house, trying to understand everything that had happened in Palazzo Rucellai over the last 500 years, I still felt very connected to New Orleans, of course, my home, but also what had just happened there. And there's a passage in the book where I'm sitting in one of the historic libraries, which is on the ground floor of another palazzo, Palazzo Strozzi, which is another famous Renaissance building just a couple of blocks away. And that, of course, Florence experienced also a devastating flood in 1966. And some of the books I was requesting had been in the basement at the time. And so I put in my request and I was told, well, we'll see in a few days if it survived the flood of 1966. And I had to wait. And it survived, and it came to me, and it was dry, but it was very bloated. I mean, you know, it had the smell of mildew and the water stains, and just holding that object in my hands was just so deeply, it felt so deeply personal, because I could understand what that book had gone through.
Of course.
And so, you know, so Katrina was, it very much colored that year in Florence.
Well, long story short, the book about the tombs went by the wayside. You started this one. So tell us about some of the highlights of this. This is a story of so much family intrigue, romance, even murder.
Well, where to begin? You know, as I mentioned earlier on, I didn't receive any formal advanced academic training in architecture. And so when I moved into the house, and I wrote about people instead, portraiture was my specialty. So when I moved into the house, another part of the narrative arc of this book is me coming to terms with being an art historian, thinking that I knew everything about the house because I knew the facade, but then moving in behind that facade and realizing, In fact, I knew nothing about the Rucellai family, or nothing about the house beyond the 15th century. And I was so intrigued. You know, I never took it for granted that I had a key to the front door of this iconic monument. And so I, in a very, I think, romantic way, saw myself as living with ghosts of the family Rucellai, 500 years of residence in this single house. And so when I heard about the murder, and that, too, just sort of floored me, you know, and I thought, how could I not know this? You know, it was a very naive relationship that I had to the house at that time. And I thought, well, there's so much more here, and I want to know what happened. And I decided that I would write this book not as a traditional architectural history. I mean, I wasn't trained to do that, and I also honestly have always found it quite boring. But I wanted to do a character-driven story. I wanted to resuscitate these lives that have played out in this house, along with the life that was playing out, you know, my own. And so that was really the impetus for writing the book. And, you know, I played around with the structure for quite a while, but it was always a character-driven history. There are the more well-known characters, Giovanni Rucellai, who's the patron of this great house, his architect, Alberti, but then other names that were so important over the course of 500 years in history just sort of disappeared a little bit from the narratives that are out there, and I wanted to bring them back into our present discourse around this house.
And this is also the story of a real love affair with a real Italian. And it ends with him having your portrait painted. Did you, yes. I mean, here you are, you're painting your own self-portrait in this book.
Very much so, yes. So that wasn't planned either, as these things go. That's right. I threw myself into this world. You know, it's also a story of escapism.
Of course.
I'm a burned out academic, you know, it fits in with the certain category of sabbatical novel, but in this case, of course, it's nonfiction. And yes, I threw myself into this world, and before I knew it, I found myself mixing with a social set that was not my own. Yes, I would go beyond Florence, someone in particular. Today, I would maybe refer to this as a romantic misadventure. the subject of that story is a 25th generation Florentine. So the historian in me was also, you know, over the moon about this, that here was, you know, I've been studying this period for so long, and here was sort of a real live specimen from the Renaissance that his ancestor had been consigned to hell by Dante for eating his children, only further sort of cemented the relationship in my mind that this was something that I should pursue. So, so that runs through the book as well. And at a certain point, he commissions a portrait of me. I describe posing for, you know, sitting for the portrait,
right,
which was a surreal experience because I had studied portraiture for, you know, all of my career, and here I was now the subject of a portrait. It always takes longer, I think, than the artist plans, and so the painting was done in the winter, and Florence in the winter can be really dreary and wet and gray, and I remember just weeks on end sitting in this glorious studio, but somewhat in the dark, and, you know, sitting on the stool and talking to the painter, who also was American and approximately my age. And so we sort of bonded through that process. But I had a lot of time to think about portraits and facades, mm-hmm, especially. And so that was a nice way to conflate the architecture with the people, to think about faces and facades and veils. So, yes, I'd write about that experience, which was really quite surreal and very special. And the portrait hangs in New Orleans today. So that came back from Florence with me. My mother has it.
Oh, that's lovely.
Her home.
Now, reading this book, I kept thinking about that wonderful book that I love so much, The Poetics of Space by, mm-hmm, Gaston Bachelard, and the quote, "The house shelters the dreamer." And this is very much a story of your taking possession of a place of your dreams.
Yes, and I thought so much about space, and certainly I think very differently about architecture as a result of this experience that I had and of writing this book. And my relationship with the house, I think, is one of possessiveness and protection. I feel so deeply connected to that space. I feel that two of us were sort of on this journey together. And it was something of a game. I mean, sometimes the house was very gracious and accommodating. Other times it was very stubborn, like getting stuck in the elevator or when my key broke in the front door and I was sort of stuck in this limbo of moving in and out of the house. So I really experienced the house as a partner on this journey. Of course, you know, I was sharing the space. It was the house that literally structured that whole journey, but I really felt like we were on it together. You know, it let me in. But it took a lot of work for me to really penetrate the spaces. I mean, that meant either roaming around the house on the weekends or the evenings and just taking the liberty of opening doors. But other times it just meant, you know, going to the archive and reading documents and letters that helped me understand what happened in the house over 500 years. And then at the end, though, my frustration and sort of my defeat was that as much as I wanted to penetrate that world, I did to a certain degree, but I could never get all the way in. And that was the case not only with the house, but also with that relationship. So it's this desire to be part of another world, if you will, and you know, denial when things aren't really working the way you had planned, but the persistence, and then ultimately, I think, you know, acknowledging the disappointment, and then at the end, just running away from it all. It ends with the sort of, you know, the toxicity of the old world that I finally am able to acknowledge and decide maybe I don't want to be a part of the old world after all, and then happily walking away from it. Then writing the book, and most of the writing was done after I moved out of the house, and again, feeling very protective of this house, wanting to tell its story, but also seeing myself maybe as a traitor. You know, the book is entitled House of Secrets, and I'm revealing a lot about the house that's not part of the public record, and particularly around the murder that took place there as recently as 1997, which was only 10 years before my residence in the house. It was still very raw, and people weren't ready to talk about it, and they still aren't today. So by putting that story back out there in circulation and talking about the house as the witness and perhaps even as the accomplice to the murder, I question how I'm presenting the house, wanting to be true to it, but also wanting readers to know about this house and the many layers of history and tension and conflict within the walls of this structure.
Well, there's a lot of pleasure for readers in your pursuit, I have to say. Oh, we've been talking with Allison Levy about her new book, House of Secrets, The Many Lives of a Florentine Palazzo. You can meet her Thursday, May 16th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Allison, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. I love talking about this book with you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, Casey Sepp discusses Insan's Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee, Sunday, May 12th at 2 at Garden District Bookshop. Judith Fiorce discusses her new book, Nearing 90, and Other Comedies of Late Life, Tuesday, May 14th from 7 to 9 at the Uptown Jewish Community Center, 5342 St. Charles Avenue. Chris Pena discusses Insan's Death Over a Diamond Stud, Tuesday, May 14th at 6:30 at the Hubble Library, 725 Pelican Avenue in Algiers. The Art of the City Book Club at the Historic New Orleans Collection begins Wednesday at 6 at 520 Royal Street. I'll be in discussion with leading authors and visual artists featured in the HNOC's exciting new exhibit, Art of the City. First up, Maurice Carlos Ruffin, author of We Cast a Shadow, and artist Ron Theron Ratliff. Free, but register at my.hnoc.org. Allison Levy discusses Insan's House of Many Secrets, The Many Lives of a Florentine Palazzo, Thursday, May 16th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Alex Kershaw discusses Insan's The First Wave, the D-Day warriors who led the way to victory in World War II. He appears Thursday, May 16th at the National World War II Museum, Louisiana Memorial Pavilion. Reception at 5, presentation at 6, signing at 7. Rob Walker discusses Insan's The Art of Noticing, 131 ways to spark creativity, find inspiration, and discover joy in the everyday. Along with Austin Kleon, author of Keep Going, 10 Ways to Stay Creative in Good Times and Bad. That's Friday, May 17th at 6 at Octavia Books. Antenna and Room 220 present Dimitris Laukos, author of Poena Domni. Friday, May 17th at 7 at Antenna Gallery, 3718 St. Claude Avenue. Casey Willems discusses his children's book, On the Bayou, A Young Dutch Hero's Adventures in Louisiana. That's Saturday, May 18th from 1 to 2 at Latter Library. Whitney Stewart discusses and signs her new children's book, What Do You Celebrate? Holidays and Festivals Around the World. Saturday, May 18th at 2 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Editors Catherine Savage Brosman and Olivia McNeely Pass and contributing poets Ralph Adamo, Daryl Bork, Ava Level-Hayman, Julie Kane, Bill Lavender, and Mona Lisa Saloy discuss and sign the book Louisiana Poets, A Literary Guide, Sunday, May 19th at 2 at Garden District Bookshop. And elsewhere in Louisiana, R.J. Lee discusses and signs The Grand Slam Murder, Saturday, May 18th at 2 at Barnes & Noble Mandeville. And there are only a few tickets left for the 6th Annual Walker Percy Weekend in St. Francisville, starting May 31st through Sunday, June 2nd. With panels, an exhibit of Walker Percy photos, and other events throughout the town's historic district. With, of course, lots of bourbon on hand. Watch for the complete schedule at conundrumbooks.com. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.